From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made at the Thanksgiving dinner in homes across America. What often begins as casual, pleasant conversation suddenly becomes an argument about, of course, politics. Maybe you've Googled something along the lines with how to survive Thanksgiving dinner politics. You'd find more than 32 million results that include advice like remain calm, avoid name-calling, or just go home, it's too hard. Philosopher Robert Talese says there's a better solution. In his work, he writes about the impact of polarization and what it means for our relationships and our democracy. In his forthcoming book, Overdoing Democracy, he argues that for the good of democracy, sometimes we need to do things that are really in no way political. We need to do them with people who might disagree with us. He calls it civic friendship, and it's meant to help us get out of our own bubbles and remind ourselves of what's really important. Is that easier said than done? Well, perhaps, but he argues that sometimes the way we retreat into our own bubbles and become more extreme in our own views is imperceptible to us. So we need to make a conscious effort to open up our relationships and conversations. How can we do that? And what does it look like? And how can it affect our very democracy? Well, his previous book is about how and why we argue. And this is someone who can really help us with this. He's in Rochester as a guest of RIT, where he's going to give a presentation titled The Problem of Political Polarization today. But first, he joins us here in studio on Connections. And he told me it's World Philosophy Day. World Philosophy Day?
World Philosophy
Day. World Philosophy Day. So, Robert, welcome. Thanks for taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Robert Talese is the author of numerous books, and he's the W. Alton Jones Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University and an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at RIT. Lawrence Torcello is the guy who brought him here. Happy World Philosophy Day to you as well.
Happy World Philosophy Day.
Yeah, so here we are, and you've got an event today. So Professor Torcello, I'm going to start with you here. Why don't you let us know what's coming up this afternoon?
Okay, thanks, Evan. Yeah, this afternoon, free and open to the public, I would encourage anyone who finds our conversation right now interesting to go to RIT, Magic Spell Studios, new building, enter the theater through 2183 or 2184. There will be ASL interpreters, and it should be a really timely and interesting talk. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I'm already hearing interesting feedback from members of the listening audience who are challenging whether it's a healthy thing to spend too much time with people who disagree with you, because everyone views right now is just different. Today is different, you know. And I, in some ways, I understand why. But I want to back up and ask Robert why you wrote the new book, Overdoing Democracy, and what you mean by that phrase first.
Sure. So one of the things that makes democracy both great but also hard to love is that in a democracy, we're political equals. We each have an equal say in major political decisions affecting all of our lives. The equality part is what makes democracy great. What makes democracy hard to love is that sometimes our fellow citizens are not as well informed from our perspective, are not as reasonable from our perspective, are not as judicious from our perspective as we would like them to be. And sometimes our fellow citizens who fit these descriptions outnumber us, and so they get their way. The challenge of democracy is to be able to regard those with whom we severely politically disagree as nonetheless entitled to political equality, entitled to an equal say. The ability to see those with whom we disagree politically as nevertheless our political equals. What makes this particularly challenging is that we as creatures are vulnerable to a particular kind of cognitive phenomenon. That is, when we engage only with the people with whom we agree, we tend to turn into, before our eyes and imperceptibly to ourselves, more extreme versions of ourselves. And when we become more extreme versions of ourselves, we become less and less able to see why those with whom we disagree are nonetheless our equals. That is to say that hiving off into like-minded bubbles makes it harder for us to preserve within ourselves the capacity to perform democratic citizenship properly.
I want to key in on an important point that Robert's making here in terms of how we sort of self-sort, because we've talked about how it's obvious that friendship groups tend to be rather similarly structured political. Even neighborhoods or where we live, and there's that interesting metric going back to 1976, Jimmy Carter won the presidency, and I think 28% of American counties were what we call landslide counties, where the presidential winner in that particular county won by 20 points or more. So 28% landslide counties in 1976. Donald Trump wins the presidency 40 years later, and it's more than 60%. We are less likely to even have neighbors who disagree with us. But on a recent podcast, you talked about how even the stores we go in or the companies we support,
yes,
where we buy a truck, where we buy a coffee. Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. So what we're seeing, is particularly in the past 20, 25 years, is what I call in the book, Overdoing Democracy, the political saturation of our social environments, by which I mean the phenomena whereby our social environments, our everyday casual encounters with strangers online at the grocery store, for example, are structured in ways that are not always easy to see by our political allegiances. So just to give one, I think, obvious example of this, just contrast what it's like to be in a Starbucks with what it's like to be in a Dunkin' Donuts. Starbucks is catering to a clientele that imagines itself as a cosmopolitan coffee drinker. The interior of the stores is designed to give you the momentary illusion of speaking a different language and being in a different part of the world. Contrast that with Dunkin' Donuts, where the slogan is, America runs on Dunkin'. These are two very different kinds of demographic appeals. And unsurprisingly, perhaps, Dunkin' Donuts tends to skew in its clientele conservative. These are people who want value, not the illusion of being in a foreign nation. They associate coffee drinking with working, with getting to work and being able to put in a good day's work. Starbucks clientele skews liberal, cosmopolitan values. They understand that the word venti is a word that means 20 in Italian. And so that's just one example. We can also look at grocery stores, Whole Foods versus ShopRite, or in my part of the country, Kroger. These also have very different kinds. They set up the environment very differently to appeal to a different kind of clientele. So our consumer behavior clearly is shaped by and marketed to us by means of an appeal to our political allegiances. And that's not all. Workplaces have become, over the past 20 years, more politically homogeneous. Families have become more politically homogeneous. Professions have become more politically homogeneous. It's very likely, for example, that your dentist is liberal, but your surgeon is conservative.
So what I want to do is explore more about why this matters and what it means for our democracy.
Good.
And I also want to talk about how we interact with each other, how
Good.
We argue, because that's your last book. And there are some themes that I think are really important.
Good.
Particularly for me as a talk show host and as someone who tries to facilitate good discussion, I read your work and I really question my own habits sometimes, which I hope is healthy, but also is pretty demoralizing, I'll be honest. But let's talk about why this matters. And some of what I want to hit on comes right from our listeners. So I just jumped on Twitter this afternoon before we came in here and I said, one of my goals is to spend more time with people who think I'm wrong. And I said, I'm serious. We're talking in our first hour today about how we become more extreme when we only associate with those who agree with us. Well, Michael writes to us and says, okay, it's good to know, though, in your community who is wearing white cheats and thinks sexual assault is okay and doesn't believe in science. That way you know who to keep your kids away from. So what Michael is saying is, once you understand that people disagree with you in modern terms, and he's drawing sort of a caricature,
mm-hmm.
he thinks it's so serious, that the disagreements are so serious that not interacting is safer for children, for families. What would you say to Michael?
Well, here's what I would say to Michael. Phenomenon that I was alluding to earlier called belief polarization, which is the phenomenon by which interactions only with like-minded others turns us into more extreme versions of ourselves. We come to adopt more extreme versions of our beliefs, has as a correlate phenomenon that as we belief polarize, as we become more extreme versions of ourselves, we also become less able to recognize variation and nuance in the views of our political opposition. So what Michael has just done is he's cast anyone who doesn't think just like him as an extreme racist threat pedophile. That can't be healthy for democracy, and we've already called it a caricature. It's a self-serving caricature. Not everyone who disagrees with you, Michael, fits that description. Maybe some do, but not everybody. The people who are your political opponents are not a monolith. And it's implausible to think that they are. But that's the syndrome that we set ourselves up for in a social environment that's politically saturated. We become unable to see nuance and variation in our opposition.
All right. We're going to return to that theme in just a second. Let me read Paul's comment. Paul says, Evan, you seem to think that being extreme is a bad thing. That's an important conversation, too. Sometimes compromise between right and wrong is partly wrong. And Paul is saying that there are times where what we perceive as extreme is simply a good course of action.
Oh, sure. So, and Paul's right there. So let's make a distinction. Maybe it's a subtle philosopher's distinction, but I don't think it's for that reason inaccessible. So what we mean by extreme here is not that the beliefs that you hold sort of tend towards some pole on a preconceived political spectrum. We mean extreme here in the sense that your belief content, what it is you believe, shifts to a more radical version of what you believed before in a way that's not perceptible to you. So extremism here is referencing a move in what one believes that is not driven by reasons and evidence and argument, but is driven by the social dynamics that are in play when one surrounds oneself with like-minded others. So the problem with extremism that is concerning for the purposes of the book that I've written is these shifts towards more extreme versions of our beliefs that are not driven by reasons, but are driven by irrational features like being surrounded with yes men.
Okay. So listeners, as we go throughout the program, I want you to think about whether you think these concepts apply to you. Do they apply to those around you? And let's have a conversation about how we can have these conversations more effectively, more productively. Let us know what you think. You can call the program 844-295-TALK. If you're dreading Thanksgiving, it's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. I want to turn to Professor Torchella for a moment because in Michael's comment, he's referencing one of the issues he references is an opposition to science. He's probably referring to climate change. Mm-hmm. Climate change has been a very important issue for you and in the work that you have done. And what Michael is essentially arguing is I don't want to associate with people, particularly if the evidence says if I associate more with people, I'm more likely to become like them. I don't want to associate with people who won't grapple honestly with the rapid deterioration of the habitability of this planet for our species. And why is that a bad thing? What would you say, Professor?
Well, first, I understand the impulse. One of the things we have to be clear about is there's a small percentage of people who aren't going to be reached on climate change, and they hold the reins of power. But there's a large group of people who can be persuaded. And if you're never engaging with that group of people, there's nobody to hold them to account. And so Michael is sort of giving up the public space to a group of people that he thinks, and rightfully so, denies the science is in an important sense outside of reality. But I think Michael also has a civic duty to be a counterweight, and as we all do, to engage in public discourse, to keep each other in check. And I think that's perhaps the healthy way to look at it, that if we're not interacting with these people that we perceive as being on the other side of the issue with us, then we're giving up an opportunity to hold those people to account.
Okay. Professor Talese, do you want to add to that on just taking climate as a single issue? Is there any single issue on social issues, on climate, that rises above this notion of you know, trying to withstand that, as Professor Torcello says, understanding that impulse to kind of recoil? Is there any issue that rises to that level?
Well, so I, sure, and I would agree that there are modes of science denialism. There are modes of racism. There are modes of views about immigration and immigrants and what immigrants are like that are beyond the pale, right? So the argument here is not an argument that says one has to engage in argument with everyone all the time at any moment that the argument might come up. And then someone like the listener says, well, I don't want to do that because these people are unreachable. So, you know, what in fact is Talese saying? That's not the view. The view is that we're relinquishing something that's central to our civic duty as democratic citizens when we allow our understanding of our fellow citizens to be consumed by a picture that we've painted of them that defines them in terms of their political opposition to us. And I think Professor Torcello is correct. When we do that, we give up opportunities for political progress. And in fact, I think we make the political situation that is already bad and maybe in some cases quite dire, as in the climate denialism cases, we make a dire political situation even more intractable.
So when it comes to the way we form our beliefs, I wonder if you agree with this. I tend to think that let's take racism and bigotry. When people in power espouse it, it's often used as a wedge tool. It's used for a sort of power holding and power increasing purpose. It's cynically used because it's effective.
Right.
Whereas when people who are not in political power espouse views of bigotry, I tend to think that they are being intellectually honest about why they believe what they believe. And I am not crediting them with anything noble, but I want to unpack why and how they got there to help maybe peel back what underpins this, and can we re-examine that together? Do you agree with that distinction between power holders and people who are not in power?
Yeah, I do. That is, I think that it is a rhetorically effective tool for galvanizing a segment of the voting population to appeal to some common fear or some common portrait that has been drawn in the minds of people who might otherwise not have very much else in common. But if they can be galvanized around a common enemy, they can be motivated to vote in a particular way. So I think it's a strategy. So I agree with that. And then there are, you know, I was about to say for better or worse, but we know for worse, fellow citizens who hold views that are in those ways deplorable out of ignorance. Yes.
Okay. And so in the same way that we, again, I'm going to generalize here, when we encounter someone who is, let's just say a white person who's racist, very likely they haven't spent a lot of actual time. And I mean beyond, caricatured time, whether it's consumption of media, et cetera. They probably don't have close neighbors, close friends, close coworkers of color. They probably don't regularly dine or have coffee with people of color. That's just generally true.
Right.
In the same way when it comes to misunderstanding religions. And so is that what we are becoming, though, as a society when we self-sort into whole communities, where we go out for coffee, where we go out to eat, where we buy a truck, where we live, when we don't really surround ourselves with anybody who disagrees, are we also risking the same thing, that we are caricaturing and not understanding people of just simple political difference?
Oh, I think, yeah, absolutely. And let me add one sort of data point to the depiction that you've given. In the cases where we are talking about various forms of bigotry that have become very prominent and obvious within the American population of late, in cases of people, for example, with bigoted views about Muslims, when they do, in fact, know and regularly interact with someone of the Muslim faith, and you ask them about that particular individual, they say things like, oh, well, that's not a real Muslim. That's not really what I'm talking about. Same thing goes with gay couples. And you say, well, you know, you've got a friend who's gay. Don't you realize that? Oh, well, yeah, but so the caricature is largely fictitious. It's largely the product of a particular kind of political rhetoric taking effect, and it's effective in motivating political behavior on the part of citizens, only insofar as citizens are able to shield themselves or avoid having to actually confront the fact that the people who are the targets of their bigotry are actually some people that they know and in many cases love and cooperate with all the time. Now, this used to be a much more prevalent and effective backstop for real expressions of bigotry because workplaces, for example, used to be the main places where individuals would have to encounter, cooperate with, get along with, share lunch hours with people who were politically, ethnically, religiously unlike themselves. As I said earlier, in the last 20 years or so, our workplaces have become increasingly politically, ethnically, religiously, economically homogeneous. And so that site of heterogeneous interaction and cooperation has been severely diminished. And I think that that's part of the explanation for why bigoted attitudes are now finding modes of expression that are largely unchecked.
Yeah, and so this part of the conversation brings my mind to white nationalism. I want to explain why. I think a lot of people have been surprised in the last couple of years how strong white nationalism can be as a movement, how much currency it has in the halls of political power, more than a lot of people want to do. Admit probably,
yep.
And how even as a movement it has seen some growth. I'm not here saying that it's perfectly mainstream, but it needs to be addressed. And so I'm thinking of this ongoing dialogue I've been having with someone who in the Rochester area who is a white nationalist who contacted me basically with an offer to just have a dialogue.
Yep.
And I've been doing that for months now. And probably if he's listening, he probably owe him an email. Now, I've got some people who say, what in the world are you doing? Why are I tend to think that that understanding where how we come to our beliefs is really valuable, not just understanding why you believe what you believe, but understanding why others believe what they believe. I think it humanizes, and some people say, well, you shouldn't humanize white nationalists. I'm with you. I've told this person who I've been having this dialogue with that I'd like to turn him.
Right.
But I also think there's a really important point that for people like him and others who are in white nationalists, the point that you're making, as I receive it, is this. We are becoming more homogeneously structured as a society by race, by religion, by political belief. And what's happening? We are becoming more suspicious. We are becoming more likely to say in surveys that that things feel more tense and more intolerant. What happened to help push gay marriage forward? Well, over time, a lot of Republicans had gay children. And I say Republicans not to be cruel, but I'm just pointing out that politically, if you're on the political right, you're less likely to support same-sex marriage. But then all of a sudden, a lot of political power holders who happen to be Republicans did know gay people, had gay friends, had gay children, and they turned. You can make the argument that why did it take a personal connection? But regardless, that helped change it. That did not make them more bigoted. It made them less.
Right.
Because they were in close contact with it. So when white nationalists argue that diversity is dangerous and the safest thing as society is to live apart from one another, even if they make a good faith argument, which I actually believe some do, they fear diversity, they fear strife. I think the evidence says that when we live closely among people who are different, that makes us less violent because we see each other as more human. To separate would be even more dangerous, even if you could do it, which you can't, because eventually you're going to have entire nation states that are just going to be inclined to strike each other in some way. I just think closer proximity is safer. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that that's correct. And I also think that let's call it now, I'll use this word in a very broad sense, the segregationist sort of objectives of sort of white nationalists and the tendencies to want to sort of build upon and deepen the homogeneity of our social environments, I think is bound to backfire for the following reason. You know, when we're thinking in terms of sort of religious divides between Christians and Muslims, for example, that's a good way to sort of galvanize and to create the image of a single community among Christians. You get a bunch of Christians together of different denominations, and that will just create the opportunity for more fissures to emerge within the Christian community. Because after all, different denominations of Christianity have very, very vehement, in some cases, theological disputes, right? They can see each other as a unified community despite those disputes in light of having some common community to see as the other, the common community to see as the non-Christian threat. You get a community of Christians together, and they're going to start having very severe disagreements amongst themselves about the right interpretation of the New Testament, about whether the Trinity is a viable doctrine or not. The kinds of things that we know from the wars of religion were pretty common among Christian sects, among fairly homogeneous Christian societies. So the tendency to see important rifts within our communities is fairly strong. And so even if you were to successfully homogenize into more like-minded groups, there'll always be the tendency to have to deal with, people who are different. And so what we need to do, I think, to preserve democracy is not figure out ways to avoid having to confront people who are different and different in ways that we think are wildly implausible and irresponsible and unreasonable. But in fact, you know, figure out strategies for getting along together with each other despite those differences, such that we can see, at least within a certain wide spectrum of such difference, grounds for seeing one another as entitled to political equality.
Okay, I've got a pile of listener email that I'm going to get to in the second half hour, but let me ask both of our guests one more question before I turn it over to our listeners.
Sounds great.
And it's on the subject of how and why we argue, which you wrote about in your last book. In fact, I'd like to just read the list of books that my guest, Robert Talese, a professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University, has written. And when you read the list, if you're like me, you probably want to go out and get them all because they're fascinating. Democracy After Liberalism, A Pragmatist Philosophy of Democracy, Pragmatism, A Guide for the Perplexed, Democracy and Moral Conflict, Reasonable Atheism, Pluralism and Liberal Politics, and the most recent book, Why We Argue and How We Should. And in that book, first of all, you wrote a little bit about Aristotle, who talked about how man wants to know.
Right.
What was interesting to me was I didn't realize there's kind of a debate about what Aristotle meant. Did Aristotle mean that man is curious, or does Aristotle mean that man wants to be credited with already knowing and not ever be wrong? And lately it feels like the latter. What do you make of that?
Well, I'm glad that you read that. It's often read as if Aristotle begins that book, which is his book called The Metaphysics, by the way, with the claim, you know, man by nature desires to know. It strikes many people as a wildly implausible claim, because how do we explain all the ignorance that seems quite willful among human beings if we're all supposed to by nature desire knowledge? And I think he's better understood as saying man likes to conceive of himself as having attained knowledge about a great many things. And by nature, we don't like thinking of ourselves as ignorant. And by nature, we don't like being duped or deceived.
Okay, well, I'm going to go forward in my own discourse, and thanks to your book, I'm going to think about the Aristotle question, and I'm going to try to adhere to the initial, more idealistic version of the question, our desire to know, because here's what I think I do a poor job of. I think I enter too many arguments with a desire to convince somebody else that they're wrong, as opposed to desire to understand why they believe what they believe and at least open up my understanding to maybe me being wrong. I don't think there's anything wrong with believing things strongly and desiring to convince others. But I think if it is so sort of one-sided in your desire, I think the whole mission of argument is flawed. And I think your book helped me see that. And I think I do a poor job of that. I just wanted to tell you that.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
But what can we do? Let me ask both. I'll start with Robert. What can we do to argue to, and because argument's valuable, as you write in your book,
yeah,
I mean, it's
yeah.
important. And not you know, shy away from engagement, but what can we do to argue in more good faith as opposed to just entering an argument saying, well, how am I going to get the knockout punch here as opposed to listening?
Right. So I think that there's a really important rule of thumb that the 19th century British philosopher John Stuart Mill articulated that, you know, sums up, I think, there's a lot of good sense in this very short quote. John Stuart Mill says, he who knows only his own side of the argument knows little of it. And that strikes me as just good sense all around. So we're interested in finding out, as you put it, Evan, what others believe, what grounds they think they have for believing it, how they came to believe the thing that they did. Even in cases when we think that that other person is dead wrong, obviously irrational, has come to the belief by means of some benighted path, even in that case, we're interested in finding that out about our interlocutor so that we can better grasp the grounds that we have for our own view. And in grasping the grounds better that we have for our own view, we can discover the ways in which we can be improved, even in a conversation with somebody whose counter-arguments are flawed, whose opposing belief is demonstrably inferior from the point of view of the evidence to our own. Even in confronting mistaken, erroneous, irrational folks, we can improve our epistemic position. And when we lose sight of that, that argument, that dialogue, that even sort of critical dialogue is ultimately aimed at seeking an improvement in ourselves and in others and is a kind of cooperative effort. It's a joint project. When we lose sight of that, I think we also lose our own grasp of what might be the, you know, a correct view, the truth about whatever it is we're thinking. We might have a true belief, but what matters for us is not merely believing what's true, but having a grasp of why it's true, what the reasons are, what the evidence is. Mm-hmm. And we lose that grasp when we don't engage with others and put ourselves in a position where we have to explain those grounds to somebody who disagrees with us. In fact, one philosopher, John Searle, famously summarized what I think is in the same spirit as the John Stuart Mill quote. Searle said, "If you can't explain it, you don't understand it."
Professor Torricello, I'm going to go back to climate change, and we've talked a lot on this program about hydrofracking, and I understand the opposition to it. What I would say is, if you cannot conceive of one understandable sort of logical reason why someone would support hydrofracking, you're not trying hard enough. And I'm not saying that we should support hydrofracking, mm-hmm. but that's one example that becomes this, it's evil, it's bad, if you believe it, you're bad, as opposed to, okay, let me understand, what are your economic circumstances? What have you been taught about climate? What have you been taught about energy? We don't really do that. How do you, and again, we all understand the impulse to kind of go to caricature mode. How do you deal with that?
Well, yeah, this is an important question. We get our hackles up and we want to argue with each other. But the only thing that I found that really works well is a very old technique that goes back to at least Socrates. And this is just asking questions, which open up a space for hopefully more constructive dialogue. Too often, as you said before, we want to show that the other person's wrong, and we want to point out all the flaws with their argument. But sometimes the most effective thing is to ask them to explain why they hold a particular view. And I'll give you an anecdote. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of disinformation out there, and it affects even otherwise bright people. And, you know, I have a lot of students, and climate change comes up in many of my classes. And one time, there was a student who kept on raising these questions about, well, a doubtful of climate change. And I would answer, you know, in respond to each one as I could. And it wasn't working until I said, you know, one particular claim, I said, well, where did you hear that? And the student said it was a video on YouTube, and the act of him saying that out loud and hearing him say it allowed him to realize that's an awful source of information. And so sometimes we just need to step back and let the person explain why they hold a certain view. And we need to take a deep breath, I think, to do that. And this particular student, you know, went up to me after class and thanked me. And, you know, then we had a nice conversation about climate change after that. So it's the Socratic method. It still works. And
I'm so glad to hear that.
I think on World Philosophy Day, we should remember to ask more questions.
About why. That's such a good anecdote. I'm going to remember that. Ask, why do you believe what you believe? Help me understand that. And at the very least, you can walk away with an understanding better of why, as opposed to, well, that person's an idiot because they don't agree with me. Let's get our only break after Professor Torcello tells us one more time. This afternoon, if you're enjoying this conversation or if you think this matters, and it does, I hope, to all of us, what's going on?
Today at RIT Magic Spell Studios from 3:30 to 5 p.m. Come on down, join us. It's free and open to the public, and all are welcome. I hope many of you will want to come and join us this afternoon.
The problem of political polarization, 3:30 to 5. 3:30 to 5. RIT. Great chance to do that. Professor Lawrence Torcello, our guest here, professor of philosophy at RIT, and Professor Robert Talese, who is from Vanderbilt University and the author of many books on these subjects. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to dive into your email next. Coming up in our second hour, our guests are Monica Sharma and Doris Gray, who have done work around the world addressing inequality and social change movements. And their work seeks to find lasting social change. That is not easy to achieve when power structures make the status quo seem permanent. We're going to be talking to them next hour about how to make change, how to make it last. Welcome back to Connections. Rich writes to us and says, I have friends who have political views that to me are rigid. They fit the description of not associating or talking to people who disagree with them. I believe there is a psychological factor there. Their views have become their identity. Any challenge to their beliefs becomes a threat to them. Please comment. That's from Rich.
This is the topic of the Overdoing Democracy book. I think, Rich, the description you've given of some of your friends is true of many citizens in the United States today and in democracies across the world. The conclusion I come to in the book is maybe obvious from the title of the book, Overdoing Democracy, is that this kind of calcification and making more rigid of political views is itself a problem that cannot be solved with more politics. The thought is that in order to address that kind of calcification of political opinion and extremity in political opinion would be to try to find new ways for people to cooperate together in endeavors that do not have politics as their organizing principle. And that's becoming increasingly difficult in a culture where more and more of our behavior is saturated by our political allegiances.
Well, I mean, I got an email from a listener who says, will the professor just tell us if he's going to talk about politics at Thanksgiving? So do you think that that we should set it aside and should we do it for noble purposes or should we address politics at the Thanksgiving table?
So here's one thing that I think about Thanksgiving dinner. I mean, I think lots of things about Thanksgiving dinner. And in fact, the bit that you began with, Evan, about the 30 million hits on Google, if you just Google, you know, surviving Thanksgiving politics, is very telling in lots of ways. So a couple of things about Thanksgiving. You know, one of the things that makes political discussion, especially sort of political disputation over Thanksgiving dinner, so frustrating is that the Thanksgiving dinner table is not a forum where citizens can interact with one another as citizens. We're interacting with each other at a family gathering. It's our uncle, it's our cousin, it's our father, it's our mother, it's our siblings. And those social ties are prior to and in some ways deeper than our relations as citizens. So there's a sense in which Thanksgiving dinner is not the right place for political disputation because it's a family context, it's a social context where other norms are in play. My advice over Thanksgiving dinner, if you are baited by your grumpy uncle, whoever the person may be, with a provocative political statement, is simply to say, we're doing something else here. Telling me about your politics is as irrelevant at this particular gathering as talking about the color of the interior of your bank. We're here for something else. We're here for family.
So if you are a supporter of this president and somebody at your Thanksgiving table says something like, well, Trump's an idiot, you might just, instead of firing back, you might say, hey, not the time for that.
That's right. And that doesn't have to be a comment designed to say, let's bracket our political differences or let's suppress our political differences. It could rather be offered as, let's rise above that for this. There's things that can be more important than politics because, after all, politics is for something. We're interested in getting politics right because we're interested in other values or making possible other values that a life can manifest. And some of those values have more to do with healthy familial relations, good friendships, relationships of loving and caring and dependency. And it's important to get politics right so that we can attend to other things in our lives. The current situation, I think, part of what's problematic about the current situation is that we're encouraged in all kinds of ways, subtle and otherwise, to lose sight of the fact that politics is for something. It's not an end in itself. It's for something.
Now, let's hit something that is not necessarily directly political, but lately it has felt very political, and that's the question of if race or something bigoted comes up at the table. At that point, you have an obligation to say something to a family member.
I think that that's right. And, you know, a lot depends on what exactly the background is, what exactly is said. So, again, this is not a, you know, an instance of sort of the what in the Why We Argue book, me and my co-author call Mom's Maxim, which is, you know, a finger shaking, don't discuss religion and politics at the table as if it were a kind of prohibition. You know, a lot turns on, you know, what the context is, and there might be contexts where even over the holiday dinner table, you're going to have to get into it if someone persists. My suggestion in these cases is to just say, look, we're here for something else. I'm happy to talk to you about the comment that you just made in some other context, but let's not ruin the good that can be happening here for the sake of getting into a dispute that we know we're not going to resolve in any helpful way over Thanksgiving.
All right. Question for both of our guests, or a comment from Colin, who wants to challenge the political left. He says, I'm enjoying the excellent guests challenging us to let us to have us let go of unhelpful and limiting groupthink and hive mind attitudes, and encouraging us to continue to maintain personal relationships with people who we disagree with politically. The growing number of voices arguing to deepen separation, isolate further, and sever personal relationships on the grounds of politics, claiming to be compelled to do so on the grounds of their progressive politics, needs to be challenged. Professor Talese exposes the inherent weaknesses in such an argument and the strengthening of remaining engaged. Splendid isolation is not a good policy for people or for countries. That's from Colin. Is that, he's calling out the left.
Yep.
Is that a particular problem on the left?
Well, depending on what you mean by particular, it's not a problem that is solely plaguing those on the left. It's a problem that runs across the political spectrum. One thing that's very interesting in this regard, I should mention, is worth noting. So when it comes to what we tend to think of as sort of hot button culture war policy issues, our country is not more divided. Is no more divided than it was 20 years ago. And if you think about abortion, stem cell research, gay marriage, in lots of cases, these culture war kinds of issues have actually seen some moderation. So if we mean by polarization the moving apart of the two sides so that there's no common ground, there's a complicating fact here. There's been a lot of moderation, and people are closer. Those who identify very strongly with the two major political parties in the country are a lot closer on what they regard as hot-button issues than they have been, and are certainly not further apart on other kinds of issues. So what has changed is our perception of the people with whom we disagree. That is, we've come to dislike the other side more vehemently. And we, because we dislike the people on the other side more severely, we attribute to them policy preferences that run exactly counter to our own. So it's sort of the dislike, the animosity, the hostility that is driving the bus, as it were, politically. It's why we think we're divided, because we dislike them more. The reason why we dislike them more, I think, is because our encounters with them are always mediated by our political differences, by our political allegiances, where parties and politicians have a great investment in perpetuating the picture of the other side as our diametrical opposition.
Hmm. Professor Torcello?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right, especially that that final point, that many politicians have an interest in dividing us. And when we realize that, well, I think politics, doing politics, engaging in politics, is something that we ought to do civilly. A necessary component of that is learning how to get past our animosities to actually engage politically with each other. So this isn't, I don't think what's being advocated is an abandonment of politics, or that by putting politics in its place, we are somehow ignoring all of the crucial issues in the world. But politics will fail us if we don't have the sort of civic relationships, as Professor Tilley says, friendships in place that are necessary for politics to function in a healthy manner. So yes, putting politics in its place. But another way to think of this is caring for politics, nurturing politics so that politics is healthy.
All right. So there's Colin calling out the left. Here is Robert calling out the right. He says flat earthers don't deserve respect or any sort of platform. People who support Trump don't deserve respect or any sort of platform. At a certain point, it isn't just that we have a difference of opinion. It is a difference in morality. Yes, not every Trump supporter is a racist or xenophobic, but they align themselves with many who are. And furthermore, saying you're not racist, but you support racist policies makes you by proxy a racist. I'm sorry, but not every opinion is valid. And again, at some point, you need to kick some people out of the table. I will not listen to a flat earther or any individual who espouses crap like, I don't like Trump's rhetoric, but he's helping the economy, because that person would never have given my opinion a shot in the first place.
Well, just notice how Robert's comment perfectly manifests the syndrome we've been talking about. So those who disagree with Robert are seen by Robert as equivalent to flat earthers. In fact, there's, you know, very little reason to think that Trump supporters are actually flat earthers. In fact, they're not. And the idea that you can move between those who voted a particular way for a major party candidate in a U.S. election and so easily assimilate them to a monolithic image of completely irresponsible, unworthy of citizenship, and therefore unworthy of an equal share of political power. Yeah, that's the problem with democracy. Now, those who hold extremist views, we can talk about that. They're not the topic of this particular conversation. We can talk about them. I think that that's a different kind of problem. What the problem is that we're talking about now is the problem that we are led by a particular kind of vulnerability to which we are all susceptible into a phenomenon, into a syndrome by which we cannot regard those who disagree with us as anything but irrational, benighted, wicked opponents who don't deserve to be democratic citizens. That's what Robert just gave voice to. And it's a symptom of a problem, not a political diagnosis of anything.
Okay. Professor Torcello, some final thoughts from you on that.
Well, I think a distinction has to be made between somebody's worthiness as a citizen versus a position's worthiness as a guide to legislation. I would agree that, you know, politicians who are moving away from a widely held and settled scientific consensus, like the one that exists on human-caused climate change, need to be called out and chastised for attempting to move legislation based upon erroneous, you know, positions. But that's at a different level of politics than the interaction between citizens. And I think that the healthy interaction between citizens, learning to have discourse and dialogue with one another, is a separate problem, but also necessary for the healthier, higher order democracy and political activity necessary for when we really want to engage in those serious battles.
I mean, which maybe just an addition to that might just be to say to someone like Robert, if you want to change this country the way you want to see it changed, your tactic, even if your emotions, you know, a lot of people can relate to them, your tactics probably won't work.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. Robert, though, thank you for that email. And Colin and everyone else who emailed the program, I couldn't get through all of them. But if you want to pick up Robert Talese's new book, when's the new book out?
It should be out in early next fall.
Okay, early next fall. He's working on a book about overdoing democracy, a great book on why and how we argue that you can read now. Robert Talese is a professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt, and you can see him at 3:30 this afternoon at the Magic Spell Studios at RIT. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
And thank you to Professor Lawrence Torchello, and happy World Philosophy Day.
Happy World Philosophy to you and all.
All right, more connections coming up.